I think all of you who read the New York Times noted that in addition to the Wright case, which had one column, there were three major columns on the op-ed page yesterday about the Middle East, and one of them begins, having been entitled "The World's Indifference," "Lebanon long ago became for me a subject to be avoided wherever possible, a memory as painful as that of a close friend, but it is time to speak and think again of Lebanon." And the theme runs through the discussions. Ambassador Seeley has spent 32 years in the Foreign Service, all but two at the beginning and two at the end have been concerned with the Middle East. So he's literally devoted his life to an examination of these issues. He served in six Arab countries, had three posts in the United States, in Washington, the State Department, and two of the three had to do with Arab and Middle Eastern affairs. So he's eminently qualified. He was political officer at the embassy in Amman, Jordan, for 2 years, vice consul for a year, consul and principal officer for 3 years at the American consul at Kuwait, an officer in charge of Arabian Peninsula affairs in the Department of State. He was chargé at the American Embassy in Jeddah and deputy chief of missions in Jeddah another stint in that area. He was country director of Arabian North Affairs, covering Lebanon, Jordan, Syria, and Iraq in the department, and head of the Jordan Task Force dealing with the Jordanian Civil War in September 1970. He was ambassador to the Republic of Tunisia. He has served as presidential envoy to Lebanon from June to August of 76, following the assassination of the United States ambassador there. In August 1978, he was appointed ambassador to the Syrian Arab Republic. He also has paid his dues in the academic community. He was a graduate of Deerfield Academy in 1940 and Amherst College thereafter, where he graduated magna cum laude and Phi Beta Kappa, president of the Student Council. Then he served for 3.5 years in the United States Army, and then taught European history at Deerfield Academy. He's had other connections with academic institutions. We feel especially privileged to have him with us to discuss the Middle East and the Arab world. We believe that he will say something about the presidency and the relationship of the domestic scene to the presidency. But we look forward also to what he'll carry us further in understanding on the subjects that the New York Times addressed yesterday. It's a pleasure to have you with us.
I had requested a lectern, but would you prefer I sit or stand? What is the preference?
Whatever you feel most comfortable with.
Well, maybe with all of us around like this, I'll remove the lectern and sit.
Okay.
Even though I requested it.
Well, one day during World War II, Andrei Gromyko, who, as you know, is quite a distinguished, from the Soviet standpoint, foreign minister, was acting as ambassador in Washington, and he came in 1942, I guess it was, to visit the undersecretary to complain about the fact that in our supply effort to the Soviet Union, we were, as you recall, shipping to the Soviet Union by rail and by truck prodigious quantities of supplies, which helped in saving the Soviets from defeat at the Battle of Stalingrad, among other things. But he came in to complain over the fact that we were delinquent and not fulfilling our commitment. He said, Mr. Secretary, you're behind on scheduling in your scheduling and the delivery of the tanks and the aircraft and so forth, and I want to know why. And the undersecretary was a polished Southern gentleman by the name of Will Clayton, who patiently allowed him to finish. And then he said, "Mr. Baster, what you say is right. We haven't fulfilled our schedule to the T, but nevertheless, I want to remind you that we've had to deliver the equipment at the Russian border and leave it out in the open where it's being rained on." And he said, "The problem is that you're not picking it up in time. You're not building the warehouses. You're behind from your standpoint, and there's nothing we can do until you do your bit." At which point, Mr. Gromyko, whose understanding of the English language at that point was somewhat limited, got up and he pounded on the table and he said, "Mr. Secretary, I came here to talk about your behind, not my behind." That's a true story. At that time, I happened to be serving as an Army officer in the Persian Gulf. We had what we call the Persian Gulf Command, the PGC. The GIs called it People Going Crazy, but it was really the Persian Gulf Command. And when the VE Day occurred, of course, most of the men and officers went home, but some of us were left behind to sort of guard the installations to keep things together until disposition was made. I mention this because it was at this point that I experienced the first significant foreign policy move made by an American president concerning the Middle East, and that was Harry Truman. It was in the early fall of 1945, rather 46, that the Soviets helped a group occupy the province of Azerbaijan and set up a Marxist government there, and the Shah sent troops to try to put it down. Well, the Soviets intervened, and his troops never got beyond about 25 miles northwest of Tehran. And I, as an Army officer, happened to be driving south from the northwest to Tehran and saw. First, I went through the Soviet troops deployed along the road, and then through the Iranian troops, who were unable to move any further north. And just after that, President Truman issued an ultimatum to the Soviets that they should get out of Azerbaijan. This is back in the fall of 1946. But following the tactics of any good negotiator, he offered them a face-saving way out. He told them that if you get your troops out of out of Azerbaijan, we will remove our remaining troops from Iran. Well, the Soviets accepted this proposition, and the mutual withdrawals began. But we in the field, who are on the spot, now face the Herculean task of disposing of millions of dollars worth of equipment and of military installations. At my particular installation, I was charged with the task of disposing of all the disposable equipment. And we only had about 5 days to do it. So we had agreed to invite sealed bids. And just before that happened, the local Khan, or chieftain, who I knew, came to me and said, "Now, I've got a proposition to make." He said, "Now, if you just let me know what the highest sealed bid is," he said, "I will top it, and then, of course, you and I can split the difference." Well, I quickly disabused him of that idea, and believe it or not, after the sealed bids came in, his was the highest. So thus did Harry Truman undertake the first important U.S. action affecting events in the Middle East in the post-war period. Now, having said that, from now on in my discussion of our presidential relations with the Middle East and issues there, I'm going to confine the subject to the Arab-Israeli question, because there's a whole range of issues that we don't have time to cover, but since the Arab-Israeli issue is so explosive and crucial, I thought I would deal with that. Now, this is very sensitive material, which is public knowledge, but I think it's wise. It's good for everybody to know. Many of you know about it, but many don't. There's probably no group in recent American history that has exerted more pressure on the President of the United States with regard to foreign policy than the political leadership of the American Jewish community in connection with the Arab-Israeli question. Now, the members of this leadership are usually referred to as Zionists. Originally, Zionists were those who favored the creation of a Jewish state in Palestine. That was what Zionism meant when it was first conceived back by Theodore Herzl at the turn of the 20th century. But of course, Israel is here to stay, and everybody accepts it as reality. So a Zionist now is not just one who accepts the state of Israel, but one who is passionately attached to Israel and tends to support Israel, right or wrong. So when I use the term Zionist, that's the individual I'm referring to. Now, this Zionist pressure has sometimes been applied directly on the White House, sometimes from within the White House, and sometimes by means of Congress, which has long been a captive of the American-Israeli Political Action Committee, which you may have heard about. It's called AIPAC for short. AIPAC has had tremendous influence in Congress. The result of these various pressures on the White House has resulted, I hate to say, in general, in a skewed U.S. policy toward the Middle East in favor of Israel and often in the disfavor of broad U.S. national interests. Well, let's take an historical look. We'll go from Roosevelt briefly in each case, each president, right, up through our current incumbent. Now, it was during Franklin Roosevelt's tenure as president that the practice of assigning to the White House an advisor for Zionist concerns was commenced. This has meant that since that time, a leading American Jew dedicated primarily to advancing Israel's interests has served as a key official in the White House. It is indeed a unique assignment with no equivalent. There is no such thing as an Irish-American or a Polish-American or a Greek-American or an Indian, American-Indian, or an Arab-American, for that matter, who serves and is assigned to the White House for a particular purpose. Now, there happens to be, as you well know, an Arab-American serving as George Bush's chief of staff. But his assignment, of course, has nothing to do with his ethnicity, and he was not placed there for advancing a special cause. Now, the question could be asked as to whether the Zionist advisor in the White House, who sometimes has an office in the State Department as well, is in a position to distinguish between U.S. and Israeli interests. Is he susceptible to what we might call dual loyalty, to harboring dual loyalty? The same question can be asked of others with a similar affinity who serve in sensitive positions elsewhere in the U.S. government. I served two long terms in the Middle East Division of the Department of State in the 1960s and 1970s, where it was clear that the Israeli embassy managed with very little difficulty to get hold of classified documents of interest. This was presumably, as far as I know, not by means of theft, a la Mr. Pollard, but was undertaken openly by individuals who, in apparent good conscience, saw nothing wrong with sharing relevant information with the Israeli embassy, whether classified or not, in the belief that our respective nations' interests are inextricably intertwined. So their intentions presumably were good. Let me just give you one example of this, and this is the case of Stephen Bryan, B-R-Y-E-N, who was Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Defense Department for a long time, who in March of 1978 was by pure chance overheard and observed in the coffee shop of the Madison Hotel in Washington, D.C., passing highly classified documents to Israeli embassy officials. Bryan kept using the pronoun we to embrace his own position and that of the Israelis. When the matter was reported and investigated, the DIA, Defense Intelligence Agency, officially determined that the disclosure of this classified information could adversely affect the national security interests of the United States. Yet, as a result of immense pressure brought on the FBI and other sections of the Department of Justice, the investigation was terminated. Now, you can read all about this in the book entitled The Armageddon Network by Michael Saba. Stephen Bryan continued to occupy his sensitive Pentagon position for years after. While I was ambassador to Syria, a sensitive and supposedly closely held telegram which I sent to the Department of State in Washington was somehow obtained by the White House Zionist advisor, who had an office in the State Department, and he passed this cable on to a congressman, Congressman Steve Solars, whose strong affinity for Israel, of course, is well known. Solars then called the Secretary of State, Cy Vance, to complain about some of the contents of my message, only to be challenged by the Secretary as to how he obtained that message. Well, now back to Franklin Roosevelt. Roosevelt had always maintained close ties with New York's Jewish community leaders. Very early in the war, he sent one of their leaders, Morris Ernst, to London to work out a plan with the UK and its Commonwealth allies to share in accepting 500,000 Jewish refugees from Europe. Agreement to do so was reached, but there was then opposition from influential American Jews who subsequently torpedoed the plan. The reason? Allowing Jewish refugees into the U.S. would, in the view of this group, undermine the Zionist movement, which necessitated moving European Jews to Palestine. If they came to the U.S., they would not be available to go to Palestine, where they would create the population base for a Jewish state there. Now, President Roosevelt's attentiveness to this community led him at one point to authorize an American Zionist leader to state the president favored a Jewish state and unrestricted immigration into Palestine. The problem with that statement was that Roosevelt had just come back from meeting with King Abdulaziz of Saudi Arabia on his way back from Yalta in February of 1945. And he had told King Abdulaziz that he, quote, would do nothing to assist the Jews against Arabs and would make no move hostile to the Arab people, end quote. Later, in the light of Arab outrage over his pledge to support a Jewish state in Palestine, the president authorized the State Department to reaffirm his undertaking to the Saudi king and to say that there would be prior consultations with the Arabs before the U.S. took any action relating to Palestine. Because of these conflicting statements, it is hard to know how President Roosevelt would have acted on this touchy issue had he lived long enough to be president when events were leading up to the creation of Israel. David Niles, who was the Zionist advisor in the Roosevelt White House and was very close to Franklin Roosevelt, said publicly in 1962 that had Roosevelt lived longer, Israel probably would never have come into existence. Harry Truman. The hard decisions about Palestine devolved upon a man who was conspicuously ill-prepared for the role in terms of both his knowledge of the Middle East and of his domestic political support. When in May 15, 1948, when Britain set a date for withdrawal of its forces from Palestine, Truman decided to support a UN plan for partition of Palestine. The idea was to partition it between 1.3 million Palestinian Arabs and 650,000 Jewish occupants. It was a masterpiece of gerrymandering. It awarded 56.4% of the country to the Jews, who comprised 33% of the population and owned less than 6% of the land. Despite the unanimous opposition of the State Defense Department, President Truman, under considerable pressure from the American Zionists, put to U.S. support behind it. And when the plan at first could not obtain the necessary two-thirds vote in the U.N. General Assembly, Truman authorized arm-twisting of certain friendly countries, such as the Philippines and Liberia, to get them to reverse their opposition votes, which they did. And after the plan was passed, the ensuing fighting that broke out over it in Palestine, as well as Britain's refusal to take any measures to implement partition, induced Truman to agree instead to an alternative plan. Some people have forgotten that. Namely, a UN trusteeship over Palestine to commence when the British withdrew. But the Zionists went to work again. And some of you perhaps read Merle Miller's oral history in which he interviewed Harry Truman. And Merle Miller quotes Harry Truman as follows, quote, "There had never been anything like it before, and there wasn't after. It was so bad that I said I wasn't going to see anyone who was an extremist for the Zionist cause, and I didn't care who it was," end quote. However, just then, Eddie Jacobson called, saying that he was in Washington and wanted to see the president. Eddie Jacobson was a close friend of Truman's from World War I service and from a haberdashery partnership. Truman described to Miller what followed. Quote, "I said to him, Eddie, I'm always glad to see friends, but there's one thing you've got to promise me. I don't want you to say a word about what is going on there in the Middle East. Do you promise?" And he did, said Truman. However, as it turned out, Jacobson welched on his promise and made his case tearfully and forcefully, reinforcing the pressure Truman was already under. And after Jacobson left the White House, the president picked up the telephone, called the State Department, and set in motion the process of having the U.S. go back to supporting partition. Ironically, even though Truman had capitulated to the Zionists in finally supporting the partition plan, the fact that the administration at one point had backed off it and supported UN trusteeship was perceived by White House advisors as having cost Truman important domestic political support. So the White House decided it had to go a little further, and it therefore concluded that the U.S. should recognize the new Jewish state in Palestine even before the partition plan went into effect. That is, before the May 15, 1948 withdrawal date for the British to withdraw Palestine. Now, when Truman informed his Secretary of State, General George Marshall, that he intended to do so, Marshall, who had a reputation of being, as you know, a very dedicated and loyal soldier, vehemently opposed premature recognition of a state that had not even defined its future boundaries. So Marshall was so upset that he went so far as to tell the president that if recognition were extended, he, General Marshall, would be obliged to vote against Truman in the upcoming American elections. Well, Marshall's protestations were in vain. Domestic political considerations won out, and the U.S. was the first country to recognize the new state of Israel when it was declared. At one point, Truman told a group of American ambassadors in Washington, quote, "I am sorry, gentlemen, but I have to answer to hundreds of thousands who are anxious for the success of Zionism. I do not have hundreds of Arabs among my constituents," end quote. Dwight Eisenhower. Eisenhower came into the office with the great advantage of being a charismatic leader with a strong political base flowing from his greatly admired military leadership in World War II. As a result, he was much better able than any other president to ignore and resist the Zionist pressures. Such was the case after the Arab-Israeli War of 1956, when Britain and France, as you recall, furious at the Egyptian president Gamal Abdel Nasser, joined Israel in launching an attack on Egypt. Eisenhower, despite the advice of his domestic political advisors, condemned the operation, temporarily suspended aid to Israel, believe it or not, and called for UN Security Council action. The U.S. supported the U.N.'s call for ceasefire and withdrawal. Britain and France agreed to withdraw, but Israel did not. When Eisenhower sent a tough message to Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion, the latter appeared to relent. But a few months later, Israel attached conditions to its withdrawal, and Eisenhower again emphasized that Israel should withdraw. At one point, the president made public the messages he had sent to Israel on this subject of Israel withdrawing. And this unleashed a storm of domestic protest. Republican congressional leaders from New York State were particularly upset. The president was warned that strong action against Israel would cause the Republicans to lose the upcoming elections. Finally, when Israel continued to procrastinate, Eisenhower issued an ultimatum to Israel. Withdraw or face the loss of U.S. aid and support. Ben-Gurion finally got the message, the Israelis withdrew, and incidentally, despite the ultimatum, Eisenhower won the next election.
would Eisenhower have won the election after having alienated the Zionists by his action against Israel had he not enjoyed such widespread popularity? Probably not. There is no doubt, this is no doubt why successive presidents hesitated to follow suit. But Eisenhower was not always on the mark concerning the Middle East. In 1953, he was persuaded by his advisors that the way to solve the Arab-Israeli dispute was to get agreement between Israel and her neighbors, all riparian states, regarding usage of the Jordan waters and its tributaries. There were disputed claims over these waters, and someone in the U.S. government came up with the idea that by obtaining agreement on how you apportion these waters, particularly between the Arabs on one hand and the Israelis on the other, then you could solve the Arab-Israeli problem. Well, the proposal appealed to President Eisenhower, and the ebullient Eric Johnston, who you recall was chairman of the motion picture industry in Hollywood, was selected to negotiate this agreement, and he came out to the area in the fall of 1953. I was then stationed at our embassy in Amman, Jordan, and like my colleagues, I was taken aback at the naivete of the undertaking in the knowledge that the politically charged Arab-Israeli dispute just did not and does not lend itself to an economic solution. Upon his arrival in Amman, and before tackling Jordanian officials, Johnston convened a private session in the embassy to pick our brains. When asked confidentially what we thought of the scheme, we told him candidly that it had virtually no chance of success. Nevertheless, we assured him that we would give him our full loyalty and support as he sought to convince the Jordanians. We had proffered our frank opinions in response to his request. As we predicted, the so-called Johnston plan for sharing the Jordan waters failed because it did not address the gut political issue, such as the grievances of the displaced Palestinians. Evidently looking for a scapegoat, Johnston told Eisenhower in his turn to Washington, the American embassy in Amman had undermined his efforts, and therefore its senior officers should be promptly transferred out of Jordan. This was ordered, and off they went. This was an experience that I, as a junior officer at that point, and therefore remaining behind, never forgot. It was also a harbinger of things to come, of more to come. As Middle East experts, or as Arabists, as some have referred to us, we became, and have become, and still are, the targets of those who favored a one-dimensional Middle East policy. And it's not hard to guess who has orchestrated this campaign. John Kennedy. Now, John Kennedy came into office determined to cultivate the newly independent nations of the so-called Third World. As you may remember, as a senator, he had already signaled his approach by supporting the independence of Algeria when it was under French occupation. The French were quite upset at that. As president, he sought to develop a personal relationship with Arab leaders and, in particular, took a special interest in Egypt and in the civil war in Yemen. Once, while entertaining King Saud at the White House in 1963, the president asked me about the background of the Saud family. After I gave him a brief synopsis, he asked that I call his secretary, Evelyn Lincoln, and give her the name of a good book on Saudi history. The next day, I did so. A few weeks later, Kennedy was assassinated. Needless to say, Kennedy's interest in Arab affairs, guess what, worried the Zionists. And for this reason, pressures built up on the White House to do more for Israel. It had previously been a constant of U.S. Middle East policy to try to limit the amount of arms sent to the area. And with regard to Israel, the U.S. policy at that point was not to be its primary arms supplier. At the same time, those weapons we supplied were of a defensive nature only. Israel's strong supporters in and out of the White House were successful in inducing Kennedy to effect a change in this policy. While the president still refused to allow the U.S. to become the primary arms supplier of Israel, Kennedy agreed in 1962 to provide Israel with a new sophisticated defensive weapon, which was the latest in the state of the art at the time, the surface-to-air Hawk, HAWK missile. Sensitive to repercussions among Arab nations, of whom the U.S. enjoyed very close relations, the State Department sought
to limit the damage by at least giving our Arab friends advance notice of our intentions. So in this connection, I was dispatched from Washington to New York, where King Faisal of Saudi Arabia just arrived, to give him the courtesy of advance notice. Unfortunately, my plane was late. By the time I arrived at King Faisal's suite at the Waldorf Astoria, New York, he'd already heard the news on TV. The Hawk missile sale to Israel marked the beginning of an escalation in the sophistication of weaponry entering the Middle East. Lyndon Johnson. Lyndon Johnson was the toast of the Zionists because of his long-standing, very strong pro-Israeli affinity. As a senator in 1957, he had fought hard to frustrate President Eisenhower's decision to impose economic sanction on Israel when it continued to refuse to withdraw from Sinai. His tenure as president was marked by a significant tightening of the U.S. relationship with Israel. In his book entitled The Israeli Secret Service by a Zionist British author, Richard Deacon, there is a description of the pro-Israeli environment in Washington during the Lyndon Johnson era. He writes, quote, "For years, the tentacles of the Israeli Secret Service had reached out into all walks of American life, not in any sinister way, as was sometimes alleged by our enemies, but in a quietly persistent manner which embraced making friends and influencing people, establishing opinion lobbies, and gathering intelligence," end quote. And Deacon continues, quote, "This influence extended into the U.S. Congress and the Senate, the Pentagon, the defense and electronic industries, the research laboratories, and such Jewish-oriented organizations as the Anti-Defamation League, the Jewish Defense Committee, Bonds for Israel, and the Federation of Jewish Philanthropies. Some of these bodies," Deacon continued, "have served as fronts for intelligence gathering, and there are few of the important congressional committees which do not possess one member or staff assistant who does not feed the Israeli network material," end quote. The foregoing influence contributed to President Johnson's decisions concerning the Middle East. Unlike Eisenhower, who had demanded Israeli withdrawal after it had taken territory by military force in 1956, in 1967, after Israel, during the Arab-Israeli War of that year, took the West Bank, Gaza, and the Golan Heights, Johnson was in no hurry to have Israel withdraw. Pursuant to the guidance of his Zionist advisors, he made the withdrawal conditional on Arab acceptance of peace with Israel. The trouble with that was that, having suffered an abysmal defeat at the hands of Israel during this war, the Arab side was hardly psychologically prepared to make such a deal at this point. And during the war, President Johnson made a couple of moves which were absolutely extraordinary in their one-sidedness toward Israel. They can only be explained, in my view, by the fact that Johnson desperately needed public support for the war in Vietnam. In this regard, he got help from Zionist leaders who, in turn, got strong assurances that the U.S. would support Israel fully in any crisis. So, to assist Israel win the 1967 war, President Johnson, believe it or not, authorized the secret dispatch to Israel of two American Air Force electronic surveillance aircrafts, the predecessors of the AWACS, which, painted with Israeli insignia, contributed importantly to the Israeli Air Force success in demolishing the Egyptian Air Force. After the Israeli Air Force, supported by Israeli torpedo boats, sunk the U.S. Navy ship, the USS Liberty, in the Mediterranean in the last days of the 1967 war, Johnson ordered a cover-up of the affair in order not to embarrass the Israelis and not to embarrass and upset his American Zionist constituents. Johnson indulged in a blatant falsehood in contending that the Israelis had attacked the American ship in error. In fact, the Israelis knew exactly what they were doing. Some 34 American naval personnel were killed by the Israelis, and 171 were wounded. The intentional nature of the Israeli attack is fully documented. Now, why would our close ally Israel pull such a stunt? Because this was an electronic surveillance ship that was in a position to intercept Israeli communications
showing that Israel was about to violate the ceasefire and occupy the Golan Heights of Syria. After the war, when the French refused to provide any more military assistance to Israel, Johnson made the decision that henceforth the U.S. would be Israel's primary arms supplier. Not only that, but Johnson authorized the first time sale to Israel of attack aircraft and bombers. Before that, we provided only defensive equipment. And the Israelis wasted no time in using them against Egypt and Lebanon. President Nixon. Aware of Henry Kissinger's strong pro-Israeli inclinations, President Richard Nixon at first instructed Kissinger, who was then in the White House, to stay clear of Arab-Israeli affairs, and the President assigned the task of handling this issue to Secretary of State Bill Rogers. Rogers, with much help from those of us working under him, and I was in the department at that time, put forward a practical Arab-Israeli peace plan similar to the formula being talked about today, which is Israeli withdrawal from the occupied territories that it occupied during the 1967 war in return for an Arab, in this case Egyptian and Jordanian, commitment to peace with Israel. Rogers received a positive response from the Arab side. He went out to the area in April of 71. I was one of many with him. But the Israelis, who didn't want to leave the occupied territories, stonewalled him in the knowledge that the powerful Kissinger in the White House, as well as the American Zionist leadership, was opposed. The Israeli lobby had gone to work deploring Rogers' quote, even-handedness, end quote. Now, even-handedness is a pejorative term in those circles, and took full advantage of its excellent White House connection. Who was that? A man by the name of Leonard Garman, the Zionist in-house official who happened to be a former law partner of Richard Nixon. Garman thus had considerable wallop with the President. In the end, President Nixon somewhat reluctantly went along with Kissinger and Garman and backed off from the Rogers plan. Nixon was always sensitive to the fact that he had drawn special criticism from the Zionists as early as during the 1954 campaign, when as Vice President he had accused the politically active American Jewish community of misrepresenting American Middle East policies abroad. Once Kissinger moved over to become Secretary of State, the presidential proscription against his handling Arab-Israeli affairs no longer obtained. Henceforth, U.S. military support for Israel escalated by leaps and bounds. In addition to authorizing the supply to Israel of immense amounts of military equipment during the 1973 Arab-Israeli War, Kissinger got Nixon's approval to provide Israel with an ongoing supply of the most sophisticated weaponry in the U.S. arsenal. So much so that some American units were denied weaponry due them for long periods of time. Thanks to the Nixon administration, Israel became one of the most modern armies in the world, and there began what some have characterized as the militarization of Israel. Jimmy Carter. Early on his term as president, Jimmy Carter addressed himself to the Arab-Israeli question. As he dug into it, he came to understand the Palestinian factor. In March of 1977, in Massachusetts, he made a statement that no other American president had ever made. He declared that the Palestinians were entitled to a homeland, meaning a homeland of on the West Bank and Gaza occupied by Israel. Well, as expected, this caused a tremendous fuss in the Zionist community, and shortly afterwards, Carter withdrew his statement. When the U.S. cast a vote at the U.N. Security Council rebuking Israel publicly for a policy of building settlements in the occupied territories, a position which was in accordance with a long-standing U.S. policy of opposing such settlements, the Zionists raised another fuss. They were also upset that the U.S. resolution referred to East Jerusalem as, quote, occupied territory, unquote, end quote, which is also a long-standing U.S. position. Rather than take the president head-on, Zionist leaders approached him through Vice President Mondale. Why Mondale? Because the vice president had become the administration's point man to both Israel and to the American Jewish community on the basis of his long record of strong pro-Israeli sentiments and votes in Congress. Mondale rushed to see the president the same day of the vote and persuaded Jimmy Carter that the State Department had wrongly advised him. Late that evening, the evening of the day of the controversial vote, the White House announced there had been, quote, a failure in communications, end quote, between our UN delegation in New York and Washington. Our UN vote was rescinded. After President Sadat of Egypt had made his dramatic visit to Israel, as you recall, offering peace to Israel, his stock understandably rose in the United States. He was invited to Washington by Carter in February of 1978, and he was described by Carter as, quote, the world's foremost peacemaker, end quote. Immediately, American Zionists concluded that the U.S. was tilting away from Israel toward Egypt. And the deputy Zionist advisor in the White House, Mark Siegel, resigned in protest. To add fuel to the fire, the White House announced about the same time that the U.S. proposed to sell 60 F-15 long-range bombers to Saudi Arabia. An important element in the rationale for this transaction was to demonstrate to Sadat and to the other moderate Arab states that moderation could pay off quickly and tangibly. But the lobby protested vigorously to the White House and Congress, claiming that the transaction constituted a threat to Israel. Five of the six Jewish senators joined other senators in opposing the transaction in a 10-hour closed debate. But there was one Jewish senator who supported the package, and that was Senator Ribicoff, who had just visited Saudi Arabia and was persuaded of Saudi good intentions. In the final analysis, it was the Ribicoff vote that helped swing enough other senators to carry the day. The Zionists continued to hound Carter during the last year in office. He was forced to fire his old political pal, comrade-in-arms, the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Andrew Young, after the Israeli government and its staunch supporters here made an issue of a secret meeting between Young and the PLO observer to the United Nations. In so doing, Carter antagonized the American black community. The latter interpreted the president's action as meaning that Jewish support was more important to him than black support. Ronald Reagan, and that will bring us to the end of this discussion, along with George Bush. In the words of former President Nixon, when Reagan assumed the presidency, quote, Reagan is probably the strongest supporter of Israel to occupy the White House since Harry Truman, end quote. In the light of this, Zionists didn't need to spend much time on Reagan personally. Instead, they concentrated on the Secretary of State, George Shultz, who assumed his post with a reputation of being sympathetic to the Arabs. It didn't take long for Shultz to oblige them. For one thing, Shultz was not getting a good press in the early months of his tenure, and he was told that if he catered to the Zionists, he might do better in this regard. In addition, Shultz was shell-shocked by his first sally into the Middle East. This occurred when in 1983 he tried to negotiate an agreement in Lebanon providing for the withdrawal of Israeli and Syrian forces. He made the mistake, however, in not including the Syrians in the negotiations and in assuming that Syria would withdraw from Lebanon, even though the Israelis were allowed by the agreement to retain some of its forces there. When the agreement failed, Shultz became furious at the Arab side and in his petulance turned toward Israel. In the course of his deep love affair with Israel and the Israeli lobby, he signed a series of agreements which bound even tighter the two sides, the two nations. One was a comprehensive strategic accord which inter alia called for close military coordination. Near the end of his tenure as Secretary of State, Shultz announced proudly to a Jewish gathering that he was seeing to it that U.S. and Israeli destinies were so intertwined, he would see to it, that U.S. destinies and Israeli destinies were so intertwined in all aspects that they could never be unraveled by any of his successors. Thomas Dine, head of AIPAC, the American-Israeli Political Action Committee, announced that no American Secretary of State had ever done so much for Israel as had George Shultz. Nevertheless, during Reagan's first year, he and Shultz diverged briefly from their infatuation with the Zionists. This happened in connection with the administration's undertaking to sell to Saudi Arabia AWACS, Advanced Electronic Surveillance Aircraft. Despite an all-out campaign launched by the Israelis and their lobby in Washington against the proposed deal, The administration did stick to its guns, and by sustained pressure of their own on Congress, got the latter to go along. It took a lot of doing, and it was one of the few times that AIPAC and its supporters have suffered a defeat in Congress. It showed what a president can do if he puts his mind to it. For once, broad U.S. national interests came to supersede domestic political interests with regard to a Middle East peace. And finally, and most relevantly, President George Bush. George Bush has assumed the presidency at a time when the Zionist lobby is somewhat on the defensive. His cause has been damaged by the repressive Israeli policy in the occupied territories in response to the Intifada or uprising, which has resulted in the killing of some 430 Palestinians, thousands of homes destroyed, and 15,000 or more persons jailed for political reasons. Other factors that have weakened the Zionist case are, first, Prime Minister Shamir's refusal to accept the internationally accepted formula for peace with Israel, namely the exchange of occupied territory for peace. And secondly, Shamir's refusal to talk to the PLO, despite the PLO's stated willingness to make peace with Israel. Furthermore, and this is important, several American Jewish organizations have now taken exception to some of the positions that AIPAC has adopted, publicly so, claiming that these positions serve neither Israel's nor the U.S. interests. Today, more American Jews are speaking out against current Israeli government policies, thus demonstrating that the Zionist leadership in this country does not necessarily speak for the bulk of American Jews. And I think this is a significant development. As a result, it would appear that the Bush administration is less constrained by Zionist pressures. Already, the president has articulated some positions which have upset the Likud leadership in Israel and the AIPAC lobby here. These include, first, refusing to discontinue the U.S. dialogue with the PLO. Second, indicating to top Israeli officials that sooner or later, Israel probably will have to talk to the PLO. And third, stating that Israel must end its occupation. The Bush administration appears to be in an excellent position, thus to pursue an Arab-Israeli peace in a balanced manner, without capitulation to one-dimensional domestic pressures, and with a strategy which serves broad U.S. national interests. And indeed, this is very important, such an approach is actually fully consonant with Israel's interests and with the irrevocable U.S. commitment to assure Israel's survival, security, and well-being. Anything less than an early peace with the Palestinians, in my view, Palestinians led by the PLO, will jeopardize Israel's future, and there are many Israelis who share this view. The Bush administration appears to be in an excellent position thus to pursue an Arab-Israeli peace in a balanced manner, without capitulation to one-dimensional domestic pressures, and with a strategy which serves broad U.S. national interests. And indeed, this is very important, such an approach is actually fully consonant with Israel's interests and with the irrevocable U.S. commitment to assure Israel's survival, security, and well-being. Anything less than an early peace with the Palestinians, in my view, Palestinians led by the PLO, will jeopardize Israel's future, and there are many Israelis who share this view. Well-being. Anything less than an early peace with the
today again, and it seems to me that is exactly the way it should be in our discourse. Who'd like to ask the first question? Maybe Dr. Miner, if he's here, ought to have the chance. Dr. Miner is the person, I understand, most responsible for our guest being here today, having saved his life at an earlier time.
That's right.
I would like to ask the
what?
Jewish.
No.
Well, it's never been stated. I've never been.
No, he's not.
Are the leaders of the AIPAC all well known? Obviously, are not.
Yeah, the key ones are well known. Thomas Dine is very well known, and some of his top men are well known. They're certainly well known in Congress, where they work very hard, very effectively. And of course, many people say that that's a very legitimate activity. There's nothing illegitimate about it. I mean, it's legitimate what they're doing, and I just call attention to it because it has skewed our policy. Now, there are Lebanese American groups that have formed in this country, the National Association of Arab Americans and the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, but they pale by comparison. They're small numbers. They don't have any passionate cause to advance. All they say is, we just want to have the United States take into account the Arab Middle East interests as well as Israeli interests as well as American interests. And that's not kind of an exciting message to try to get across. But they're working, and they do try to make known their views. And in particular, the second group, the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, it focuses on the anti-Arab image that's developed in this country, flowing from a number of factors. One, the terrorism in the area. Some of it has been undertaken by Palestinian terrorists, some by Iranian terrorists, and Arabs get blamed for it. Or the kind of conventional sort of stereotype image of an Arab riding a camel. So Arab, the term Arab and Arabs in general are made fun of, and in movies and films and TV scripts and things. So the committee tries to offset that and point out to the writers and the producers that they're really going a little too far, without meaning to perhaps, in identifying the Arabs in a negative way. I mean, people don't do that about Poles or Italians or Jews or Indians anymore, and so this is one thing they're doing and having some effect, I think.
What would be your reaction to an opposing thesis that tries to explain all this? It is that, as Churchill said when the State of Israel was created, that the creation of the State of Israel is an event in world history. It's a moral achievement. And as you remember, theologians, Protestant theologians, were equally emphatic in defending and supporting the creation of the state against George Marshall and against the people. Then, according to this thesis, as time went on, Israel began acting in the occupied zones and elsewhere, and in its concern for its security, like every other state. It began abusing, to some extent, its power, and it the thesis of moral exceptionalism got modified for people who take this view, and they said, well, we should treat Israel as we treat other states when they threaten the balance of power or when they do this or that. That, in a sense, that is a little bit less conspiratorial than the notion that the big push from the beginning came from a handful of Israeli lobbyists. But
I don't think there's any question that about the existence of Israel. There certainly was a tremendous sentiment after World War II, in the wake of the horrendous Holocaust, that some place had to be found for the Jews, and Palestine was considered to be a logical place for them to go in light of biblical connection. So, in my dissertation, I didn't intend to in any way suggest that Israel should not have been created or that one should not defend and support its continued existence. What I was trying to do was just indicate, particularly in the last 30 years, where one-dimensional interests have come into play, where we've gone beyond just supporting Israel to supporting Israeli policies that are wrong and bad. And I would submit they're wrong and bad for Israel as well as for the United States. Because if you look way ahead, in a 25 or 50-year time frame, and you study the demographics of the area, including within the area occupied by Israel, both Israel proper and the occupied territories, one will find that the overwhelming demographic pressures may become overwhelming, that even within Israel in 20 years, within his territory controlled by Israel in the absence of a peace settlement, there will be more Arabs within Israeli-controlled land than there will be Jews, which would face Israel a serious dilemma. How do you, if they're a majority of Arabs and you claim to be a democracy, how can you maintain a Jewish state? And this is a dilemma many Jews in Israel are worried about. And therefore, it seems to me that the Zionists in Washington have tended to ignore what are Israel's true interests. They've gotten so caught up in defending Israel right or wrong that they have ignored what Israel should be doing to serve its long-run interests. And I think that's been the mistake. And that's why it's significant now that there are groups, for example, within Israel. I was there last November and met with two groups like that. One is a group called the Committee on Peace and Security, composed of 200 retired Israeli generals and colonels who whose objective is to persuade the Israeli government to agree to a two-state solution, evacuate from the occupied territories in return for peace, and base this on what they consider the absolute imperative that Israel get off the territories in the interest of its long-range security, that this is something in Israel's vital interest. So there are groups like this speaking out more and more in Israel. And there are American Jews, I indicated, in this country saying the same thing. The trouble of the Zionist lobby is that for a long time they weren't listening to these people and they were moving ahead with what unfortunately has become is a hardline Israeli government. I think if the Likud party had not come in 1977 and you had a somewhat more enlightened labor government in power, things would be better now. I think the labor government has never rejected this UN resolution that I talked about, the formula for peace. I think they would be more disposed to talk to the PLO. So that it's just regrettable now that we have in position Israel government, which is very hard line, represented by Mr. Shamir, and has been very hard for the Conference of Jewish Presidents and the Zionist lobby here to criticize or take any exception to its policies. That's been the problem. And now others are speaking out, taking exception to its policies.
Next question. Bill Harbin.
Mr. Ambassador, could you comment on the U.S. relationship with Syria? It seems in the period of 69 to 72, with which we were there, our children could go to Palmyra, stay overnight, eat with the Bedouin in the desert. The women's club took off for Latakia with the men, and we just had free run. We could drive our cars across, treated with the utmost courtesy. We never even had to shop in Damascus, never even had to get out of the cab. Cab drove us to Damascus. They just passed us right on through. And I just wonder that the deterioration of the relationship and Syria becoming sort of the bad boy. I wonder whether the U.S. government's tendency to treat them as a Soviet surrogate, where they're fiercely proud, and when we discuss matters with the Soviets concerning their interests, whether this doesn't have an adverse reaction to all all that we're trying to accomplish.
I think that currently the U.S. government has a pretty good reading of Syria, but you're very right. In the past, there's been a tendency to see Syria as a Soviet surrogate, as a radical state with which the U.S. cannot work, and so forth. But I think that there's been a more accurate perception of Syria. Namely, Syria is run by a very shrewd leader, President Assad, a minority group, the Alawis, who are basically there to maintain power and to survive. They rely heavily on the Soviets for military equipment, but ironically, they pay absolutely no attention to what the Soviets want them to do. In other words, Syria ignores the Soviets when it comes to Syria's interest in the region. It's very much like our relationship with Israel. We provide Israel with $3.5 billion worth of aid every year, but Israel pays very little attention to what we wanted to do. And we've asked Israel to stop the settlements, we've asked it to do this and that, and it thumbs its nose at us. The same thing is true of Syria. It gets all this military equipment from the Soviet Union, but when the Soviets say, don't go into Lebanon, Syrians pay no attention. When the Soviets say, get together, Arafat, and Assad has a strong animosity toward Arafat, the Syrians pay no attention. So I think the United States understands that Assad is not a Soviet surrogate. At the same time, the U.S. has been concerned by indications of Syrian terrorism, which the State Department says they have ended, at least for the time being. I think the U.S. recognizes that you cannot ignore Syria. I mean, whether it's this or that, it does occupy a pivotal position in the area geographically. It is still an important Arab country to contend with. It has a role to play in Lebanon, whether we like it or not. It is playing a role there, and therefore we can't ignore that. And so we must have a relationship with it, and eventually to have a comprehensive Arab-Israeli peace, Syria, of course, has to be included. Now, in terms of day-to-day relations, you will find that Syrians and Americans get along very well. Even during the height of tensions, when I was in Syria, I was there during the Camp David Agreement, 1978, which the Syrians strongly opposed. And our official relationship cooled off perceptibly. But that didn't mean the Syrians weren't very friendly to us. You jump into a taxi in Damascus, and the taxi driver would turn to you and say, are you Soviet? And you'd say, no, I'm American, and he would be very happy. Probably because he had a cousin in Detroit. Probably one out of four Syrians has relatives in this country. So the Syrians basically are very easy to get to know, and you can still travel around the country without any problems. And it's very secure because it's a police state. I mean, in a sense, it is very tight security, but foreigners can travel around, and even Syrians themselves are left alone as long as they don't criticize the regime. They stay out of politics, they can go back and forth, and so forth. The Syrian role in Lebanon right now is not a happy one. I think we ought to keep in mind, as reprehensible as the Syrian shelling of East Beirut is, we ought to keep in mind who started it. It was General Aoun, the sort of self-styled president of Lebanon, who is not the acknowledged president, but he kind of declared himself that, started it by trying to insinuate himself into Muslim areas in West Beirut, blockade the ports there, and that started off this exchange. Now, that doesn't excuse the heavy Syrian shelling, but let's keep in mind the Maronites have been shelling the Muslims as well. But the press, somewhat influenced by the friends I've been talking about during my dissertation, have identified Syria as, you know, the only person at fault in this particular operation.
Next, Helen Hamilton.
I'd like to ask, the opinion has often been expressed that if the hostages were no longer front page news, their captors would release them. Well, the hostages have been front page news for a long time. What do you think their chances?
I'm afraid that's not the case. The hostages are held basically by one or two Iranian groups, either Hezbollah party, which is a party very closely linked to Iran, and the Islamic Jihad, also with Iranian links. The stated purposes, at least, there may be three or four groups, but they're more or less in this vein. As far as most of the hostages are concerned, of the American hostages there, the only demands that have been made so far, and that they've been long-standing, is that they will release them if the Kuwaitis will release the terrorists who went into Kuwait some years ago, orchestrated by the Iranians, and blew up part of the American embassy and installations there, tried to assassinate the ruler of Kuwait. And the Kuwaitis have held fast. Now, those of you who read the recent Contra hearings know that quietly and unbeknownst to Weinberger and Schultz and the rest of us, Ali North and the others tried to persuade the Kuwaitis to release these people. And here the U.S. had always taken this position, we never give in to terrorism. You know, once you start giving in and making a deal, then you open up a Pandora's box. And the Kuwaitis said to us, what are you talking about? We're following your policy of not giving in. Well, of course, the Kuwaitis did not give in. I think that that demand is still on the table. Now, some people were hoping that after the Iran-Iraq war ended, with the serious psychological setback that the Iranians had really faced, because in a sense, the war was a defeat for the Iranians,
They had made, as you know, demands that they would never end the war until the Iraqi regime collapsed or was removed, and of course continued. The Iraqis who had the initiative in the battlefield. So some people are hoping that in that atmosphere and an effort maybe to reestablish its international connections, Iran might authorize their release. They haven't. I'm afraid that there doesn't seem to be much prospect. I understand that we've been close negotiations with Syrians who do occupy much of Lebanon, and they presumably occupy most of the places, if not all the places, in which the hostages are located. The Syrians apparently tell us, we know where most of them are, they move around, of course, but for us to go in and attack, or, you know, with a large force and surround these places, we're afraid that the hostages would be killed, and they're probably right. Syrians are not very good at this sort of thing. Somebody else might be able to do it in a more sophisticated manner, but I'm afraid the Syrians, they've killed many of their own soldiers and the hostages and the guards and everybody. So that's not a very good option. But we do keep working, talking to Syrians, I understand, on this issue, but we have no dialogue with the Iranians on this issue. For a while, there was a more pragmatic faction in Iran emerging into the leadership under Rafsanjani. It looked as if Iran was moving in the direction of a relationship with us, and then maybe we could engage in dialogue concerning the hostages. Unfortunately, at about the time that the Satanic Verses book came out by Rushdie, and that wasn't the reason for it, but they used that as an occasion to rally Khomeini used that as an occasion to rally the ideologues, and now for the time being, the leadership has shifted to the ideologues. So the prospects of Iran making a gesture are even less now than they were a year ago, I'm afraid. So it's very sad to say one doesn't see much hope in the immediate future.
One or two more questions. Howard Cromwell.
Quite often we read, when talking about a Palestinian state, the coupling of the Gaza Strip with the West Bank. And when I look at the map, it seems so impractical to have Israel in between those two that how in the world can, what is the logic of trying to harp on that?
Well, no one is, that's of course quite far off. The idea is the Palestinians want to have self-determination. Practically speaking, it's also unrealistic to expect Israel to allow a corridor between the two, which would be a Palestinian corridor. But you have examples in the past. East Prussia was separated from Germany for a while. If you have peace, anything is possible. That's the bottom line. I mean, one can debate a lot of Israelis. I think most Israelis are inclined to want to make some kind of deal with the Palestinians, but they suspect that they don't trust them, that they can't count on them limiting their aspirations to just the occupied territories. They say, well, once they're there, then they want more and more. And so it's an understandable skepticism. But the point is that if you negotiate a peace, then you develop a whole new range of relationships that exist in a peaceful environment. And it seems to me that can be worked out without any problems. And Israelis, in a sense, hold them hostage that way. Because if the Palestinians in the West Bank act up, they can say, we're not going to let you into Gaza. So I have argued with Israelis that I think it serves Israel's interest to have a better interest to have a Palestinian state there in the West Bank rather than have the West Bank linked to Jordan. If the West Bank is linked to Jordan, its whole orientation is eastward into the Arab main matrix, and it tends to sort of set up more of a barrier between Israel and the Palestinian state for the future. But if there's sort of sequestered between the Jordan and Israel, with open borders on both sides, the tug to Israel is going to be overwhelming. I don't mean just an exclusive tug, but the opportunity, in fact, is close to the Mediterranean, the fact that Israel has so much to offer the new state, that I think Israel would benefit from that alternative more than it would from a state that was looking in the other direction. Mm-hmm. But so I think that could be worked out at Gaza, West Bank relationship.
Dr. Miner?
If the Israeli government could be persuaded to deal with the Palestinians, and they worked out a deal by which Palestinians would be able to move back into the West Bank, which is not to be connected with Jordan,
because Jordan doesn't want it there. How many people would be accommodated by this limited area? Not nearly all the Palestinians who were apparently displaced.
Actually, Jordan is very happy to have a confederation. Now, confederation means two separate federated nations. But Jordan still would like to have a relationship, close relationship. That doesn't mean there can't be also orientation elsewhere. It's a good question. It's the West Bank and Gaza. Gaza, of course, is very limited in an area that can be where people can settle. West Bank has a little more potential, but it's still a small area. And, you know, there are about 800,000 Palestinians living there now. And the estimate is that there are altogether maybe 4 million Palestinians. Well, clearly 4 million Palestinians, or 3 million plus, are not going to go back to the West Bank. Because the issue is really, in a sense, not so much territory per se, but territory as a vehicle for identity. The Palestinians have been kicked around, not just by the Israelis, but throughout the Arab world ever since they were dispersed in 1948. You go to Saudi Arabia, you go to Kuwait. Now, many of them have established themselves financially, commercially very well. They're well off in terms of resources, but they're viewed as second-class citizens in those countries, and they can be kicked out any time they want. They don't have any rights. They don't have any passports. So what they're looking for is an identity, a passport and a flag, a place to call their own, and a place to go to. If they're you know, discriminate too much, they can still go there and you know, build a house and buy a taxi and or something like that and operate a little shop. But they probably won't, because they can make more money in the Persian Gulf and make more money elsewhere. But it's an outlet for them, and it satisfies a psychological need. And I think that's an important element to keep in mind. People forget that. Because sometimes you hear the argument, oh, well, I mean, it's impractical to have a state because you can't fit 4 million people there. But that's not what they have in mind. Now, you certainly can bring in a lot more than there are there. People say it's economically unviable. But let's face it, Israel has never been an economically viable state. Yet it's a flourishing state. It would collapse without $3 billion of American aid. From the very outset, when these wonderful farms were built in the desert in Israel, those were uneconomic. I mean, that was done, money was pumped in, but you didn't get any proportionate return. It was a laudable venture because it helped build up Israel. So I think in the case of the West Bank, you need some pump priming from the outside. It won't get the money back, but it'll prime the pump and hopefully expand the economy to an extent that it can absorb maybe a few hundred thousand more.
One sense is the development, although it's really hard to actually visualize, of a feeling among many of the Palestinians who still reside in the West Bank that they're not related necessarily to Jordan or the Palestinians as we know them, but that they're residents of this area. It so happens that Israel is in control of it now. But they, I'm not expressing this very well, but there is a growing feeling that they're native and that they're not Jewish, and not necessarily like the other Arabs.
Well,
do they pose any problem between the incoming Palestinians who might choose to settle?
The younger generation, those who started the uprising, those who were throwing the stones, were born after the occupation started in 67. They've never experienced a Jordanian administration, so they have no particular feeling toward being with Jordan. All they've known is occupation by the Israelis. So they definitely have very much a consciousness of being West Bank Palestinians. Now, a number of the Palestinians living in the West Bank fled, of course, from what is now Israel proper. They don't tend to make a distinction between the West Bank as Palestine, as different from Jordan, or what was formerly Palestine before Israel, because that whole area was not separately delimited. As you know, Syria, Lebanon, what is Israel, and Jordan in the old days, in the Ottoman Empire, before World War I, was known as Bilad al-Sham, which in Arabic roughly means the Syrian area. So in those days, you weren't called necessarily a Palestinian or a Lebanese or this or that. You were from your tribe or from your locality, but if you had a broad generic term, you were from the Syrian region. And sometimes people forget that when they talk about what does business to Syria have in Lebanon and why are they there? Well, you have to keep in mind that Lebanon was carved out of Syria as a separate entity by the French to give the Christians a special role there. But it's always been a kind of Syrian territory. But in terms of go back to your point, I think that the West Bankers, to carry your point a step further, one of the significant aspects of this uprising is that it reflected also the discontent of the people living there with the PLO leadership. The fact the PLO leadership was living high off the hog and was advocating this and that, but wasn't dealing with the day-to-day problems facing the West Bankers. Increasing encroachment of Israeli settlements, increasing arrests, increasing harassment, increasing this and that. And they said, my God, what's the PLO doing to stop this? If they don't stop it, eventually the Israelis will take over everything, we'll have nothing left. So these young people were the ones who really forced the PLO's hand into finally seeing political sense and agreeing to make peace with Israel. And it was mainly the pressure of these people right on the West Bank. And they're the ones who feel that and understand that they have to live with Israel. You know, they don't like the occupation, but Israel's there next door. Thousands of them worked in Israel, you know, every day. They go back and forth. They weren't allowed to live in Israel. They crossed the border in buses. They learned a lot from Israel and some of the experiences they had there, admired much of what Israel's doing. So it also built bridges. So I think that you're right in the sense that the West Bankers, the Palestinians there, have helped to set the stage for a relationship, a peaceful relationship between Israel and the West Bank Gaza. Any other one back here?
Yes.
How you describe the situation, the Congress of the United States and the President seem to have buckled under to this lobby of the signed. To what do you ascribe this power?
Well, now, if I know you probably give me hell for saying this, but this is an in-house group, and I'm speaking very frankly. Dollars and cents.
Money.
Very simple. They're very effective in putting money into congressional campaigns, and you could cite any kinds of instances where a congressman or senator has had the temerity. Let's take one or two examples. George Percy had the temerity at one point to advocate selling APACs to Saudi Arabia. Black mark. So what happens? In Illinois, the Zionist community organized bell ringers, hundreds of young kids who went to Illinois and rung bells and sent out leaflets and so forth for his opponent, and he was licked on that issue. Let me give you another example. Paul Finley was also from Illinois, a congressman, happened to stumble into the Arab world. He had a constituent who was on a plane flying through Aden. And somehow that constituent got off the plane, took a picture, and of course it's a Marxist dictatorial state, and he ended up in jail. And nobody could spring him loose, so Finley went out, personally talked to the leader, and got him sprung loose. He began to think about this area, it's an interesting area. He began to see our policy is one-dimensional. So Finley said, why aren't we talking to the PLO and the Palestinians? The key element in the peace settlement is the Palestinians, the PLO speak for. So he comes out to Damascus when I'm there, and he meets with Yasser Arafat. And Arafat makes some very forthcoming statements. Finley went back. His next election was very close. The election after that, he lost. They had these leaflets with pictures of Finley with his arm around Arafat saying, Finley is terrorist lover. And the money went on his opponent and he lost. Now, you multiply this dozens and dozens of times. And this is a fact of life. I can give you any kind of documentation. And they intimidate congressmen. And you go on the Hill, and the congressman will say, look, I know I shouldn't vote this way, but what can I do? I might lose the next election. That's a fact of life. Yeah?
Can I ask a question? I'd like to have you make a comment on the impact of the recent ad or let's say statement of a number of anti-Jewish leaders, rabbis, and important people, full page in the New York Times.
I think it's an example of what I was saying earlier.
That's what I
there are,
kind of confirmed.
More and more American Jews. I would imagine if you took a private poll of the American Jewish community in this country, you would find 80% at least who favor exactly what I'm talking about, what we all favor, a peace based on this formula. But they've been afraid to speak up because they're then declared as being disloyal. I don't know who they're being disloyal to. They're not being disloyal to the United States. But anyway, they're being disloyal to their community, I guess. But now they're not afraid as much anymore because they see where Israel's interests, true interests, really lie. And I think we'll see more of this. And as I say, I think the lobby is on the defensive. And I think that I find myself in my lecturing. I've never, by the way, ever lectured on this subject before. It's the first time because of the nature of your institution, President, and this kind of thing. And I would not, I probably wouldn't say this out in the public because I would have AIPAC all over me. And the Jewish Defense League probably would have a bomb outside my door. But I have spoken out in terms of where I think Israeli policies are wrong, and I'd get some flack from members of the community who get up and make these speeches, very, very discourteous, very aggressive, very unfriendly. And I say, look, I'm just trying to express my views, what I think is in all our best interests. Now there's less of that. The other day a rabbi came up to me after and said, I agree with everything you had to say. So I think they're coming out of the woodwork now, and I think that's going to be good because that'll have impact, I hope, on Congress, on the President, and we can move ahead and have peace for everybody.
Well, I thought that ad was very impressive.
Great ad.
Read down those names, and I couldn't begin to know any, but you could recognize the impact of these scholarly and rabbinical influence.
There is another good ad put out by the National Association of Arab Americans. You may have seen it with four columns, something like that. U.S. position, Israeli position, and the PLO position.
Mm-hmm.
And in every case, the U.S. and the PLO on the same wavelength, I think one or two, except one or two cases.
The witness the recent interview by Nikhil Lair of Arafat.
Yeah, I have to say, Yasser Arafat is the worst possible PR man that the Palestinian appeal can have. And all that, every time he appears on TV, I'm sure it reinforces people's views. The PLO is ipso facto terrorists, they can't make peace, and they're a bunch of slimy characters. But having said that, I must say he came quite a distance.
Yes.
For a change, they're being smart. The Arabs normally are pretty stupid about how to handle public relations. Normally, they reject things out of hand without tactically saying, well, maybe there's something to be said for it, even though there isn't, just to keep from being viewed as rejectionists. Now, Shamir comes up with his proposal for elections in the West Bank. Well, you know, and I know that this is just a way to get off the hook, to please the United States, to avoid having to make peace, but somehow maybe I can get away with it. But by elections, he means to be tight control, to be, you know, he'll watch to see who the candidates are, and they'll be so forth and so on. Well, Arafat said, look, I favor elections as long as part of a package deal. What he meant was, if it leads immediately to negotiations and then eventually a Palestine state. That's a smart move. He's not rejecting it out of hand. Now, maybe the Arabs are learning a lesson. And I'd like to see someone like Edward Said be the PLO spokesman. You know, Edward Said from Colombia. He's, of course, he's American, but he presents the Palestinian case so well, and he makes such a good impression. Yeah.
Early in your talk, you mentioned that FDR made different statements too in Saudi Arabia and later, and you also indicated that perhaps had he survived, there would have been no Israel state.
That was the Zionist advisor saying that.
I see.
This is David Niles who said that.
And your view of what would have happened had FDR survived?
I have no idea. I kind of feel probably would have happened. That's my feeling. But I only quote it because it's so remarkable for the Zionist advisor to say that.
I see.
It might have happened in a different way. It might have happened in a more transitional process. With a minimum of blood, well, it probably still would have been bloodshed. But
there was some feeling that FDR was not up to his old self at Yalta.
Yeah.
Do you think that perhaps memory losses would have accounted for the difference in his statements in these two areas?
Not necessarily. You know, the British did the same thing after World War I. They promised the Jews the national home in Palestine. They also promised the Arabs an independent state, which include Palestine. So politicians tend, you know, to try to satisfy all constituencies.
One final question, Victor.
Mr. Ambassador, does Ken Weissman or Al-Eben have any impact in Israeli politics?
Al-Eben. Ken Weissman is dead.
Oh, is he not?
The general's son, maybe.
Oh, Ezra Weissman. I'm sorry, Ezra Weissman. Yeah, Ezra Weissman. Marginal, I'm afraid. Ezra Weissman, of course, used to be Secretary of Defense, was a strong supporter of the Likud hardline policy until he was involved in negotiations of the Camp David agreement with Sadat, and his whole vistas changed. He realized that we can make peace and we should make peace on the PLO and so forth. I'm afraid they're both kind of crying in the darkness. In fact, Eban has lost his parliamentary seat. He used to be head of the Foreign Affairs Committee in the Knesset. And the interesting thing about Eban, he is talking no differently from the way he did 25 years ago. And when he was talking 25 and 20 and 15 years ago, he was the toast of the Zionist community. But the Israeli government moved to the right, because when Likud came in, Begin in 77, they moved far right, more intransigent, much more less conciliatory, and the Zionist leadership moved to the right with them. But Eban stayed right there in the enlightened center. And Eban favors withdrawal. He says it's important, it's necessary. It's the only way we'll have peace, we have to do it. I'm afraid, as I understand it, his influence is marginal, but hopefully with more Israelis speaking this way, maybe it'll have some impact. I think that before it can have impact, the Likud will have to finish its term. Up till now, as you know, in Israel, there's never been a clear majority. There have been the Likud and the Labor have won roughly the same number of votes. And they have proportional representation. Actually, they really should change their system. So these minority parties, many of them are religious right parties, can swing a vote. And they tend to be conservative, so they tend to get the Likud, support the Likud. Although this is a coalition government, in fact, Likud occupies the key foreign policy position of prime minister, foreign minister. Now, when in the next election, maybe with the groundswell of feeling in Israel and among the American Jewish community here, and the American Jewish community here has some impact in Israel. Look what happened with regard to the law of return, how they used their weight and got it changed. I think the best hope is through these two groups that eventually have some impact, and maybe in the next election, Labour Party comes in. Now, I'm not saying the Labour Party is necessarily willing right now, but even Peres has not, in a statement a few weeks ago, did not rule out the possibility of talking with the PLO. And of course, Peres says, yes, we must get off the West Bank and Gaza. We must deal with it. So you have a new ball game with them. Then you can speak in common terms, and I think that could be the beginning of some hope, provided that the PLO can hold on until then, because you've got some extremist elements in the PLO. They're being kept pretty much under control right now, thanks partly to the Soviets, by the way. At the Palestine National Committee Council meeting, which is the PLO parliament composed of 500 Palestinians, where they approved decision to make peace with Israel, recognize Israel, they had about 60 opposition votes from the extremists, 60 out of 500. They wanted to disrupt the whole thing. They wanted to negate any vote in favor. The Soviets used behind the scenes their influences. Two of these groups are Marxists. They said, look, you guys, we favor peace too. We don't want you to upset the apple cart. Vote against it in the committee, but don't cause problems. So they voted against it, and in effect they've told Arafat, we'll give you time, but if you don't deliver, and if he has to wait another 3-4 years in elections, it may be that the PLO will have to move to a more radical position and pull back from this. I mean, that's the danger of waiting any longer, too much longer.
We're grateful to two people for this stimulating discussion and program. One is Emmett Ford, who has always kept the Miller Center in mind. Ambassador Seeley will be speaking this evening, as I understand it, to the Council on Foreign Relations. Emmett Ford is the prime mover of the council's program, and every time he has a speaker, he kindly thinks of us, and so we're very grateful to him. But we're also grateful, obviously, primarily to Ambassador Seeley, and you've given us a lot to think about. Don't always hear it, and so we're glad that we heard it here.
Thank you very much.